You're listening to the Humans of DevOps podcast, a podcast focused on advancing the humans of DevOps through skills, knowledge, ideas, and learning, or the SKIL framework. Here's your host, DevOps Institute CEO, Jane Grohl.
Hi, everyone. It's Jane Grohl, CEO of the DevOps Institute, and welcome to another episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. I'm here with Michaela Zanini, one of the authors of the recently published book, Humanocracy. Michaela, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me. So I, as Jane mentioned, I'm the co-author of Humanocracy with Professor Gary Hamel. I've been a partner of Gary's for the last decade at the Management Lab, where we are, you know, working really hard to usher a new way of thinking about management and organizations, and just helping organizations become as capable as a human being inside of them. Prior to that, I spent over a decade at McKinsey & Company, and earlier than that, at the RAND Corporation, which is a public policy think tank in California. And maybe that's where I could start in terms of my background and how that led me to this book, Jane, because, you know, I came to RAND in the mid-1990s and a young researcher doing a PhD. And I was working on a project. RAND does a lot of work for the U.S. government. This project was for the U.S. Air Force, and it came in the wake of a terrible bomb attack in Saudi Arabia against Air Force barracks. And the person in the organization that claimed responsibility was Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And at the time, he was not a household name, as unfortunately he became later on. But, you know, the U.S. Department of Defense was interested in learning more about him. And so I got involved in a project learning a little bit more about him and the organization he created, which was very different from the typical kind of top-down bureaucratic terrorist organization that, you know, was really the norm. You know, Al-Qaeda was highly networked, highly centralized, loosely organized, without an office, without filing cabinets, without an address. And this presented tremendous challenges for ways of countering it. And what we soon discovered as part of the research is that, you know, the information revolution really enabled, you know, terrorist groups, just like any other organization, to fundamentally change the way it operated. And it made it much more difficult to counter. And so the whole premise of the research that I did at RAND and that led to a book called Countering the New Terrorism was the fact that, you know, as terrorist groups were becoming networked through the revolution in information technology, so did, you know, governments, and those who sought to counter them had to rework and rewire their own way of managing so that they could be as nimble and as, in a way, innovative as some of these terrorist groups. So that was, in a way, what planted the seed in my head that thinking about organization was a really, really important aspect. So for even, you know, thinking about how strategy and capabilities within an organization get set and get improved, right? So you can think about operating models and business models as much as you want, but underlying those at the bottom of the stack, if you will, is the manager model, right? How an organization is making decisions about the strategy it pursues, how resources get allocated, how roles get defined, how can abilities get set, and so on. And that is the most powerful and, in a way, the most fundamental engine that determines success.
But and it's really interesting to me because when you look at where we are today, and so, you know, as I told you before we started recording, DevOps Institute's mission is to advance the human elements of DevOps. And I would, you know, I think clearly feel comfortable saying that 2020 has been the year of the human, because not only did we have a human crisis in the form of the pandemic, but organizations had to shift their models very, very quickly. And it's interesting to me, kind of watching it from the tech space, that the organizations that were nimble, that had, you know, what did you, I don't remember what you said, but it was like loosely coupled, right? Where it wasn't so tightly constrained that they were able to pivot very quickly. And it wasn't just pivoting the work from home. Certainly that was a big piece of it, but also pivot their operations, be able to stay in business, be able to continuously compete. You know, before the pandemic, they were facing disruption from these, you know, these startups like, you know, Uber, right, or Airbnb. You know, now we have a pandemic. So this has been an interesting year. What have you seen? I mean, have you seen any kind of a awakening, if I want to call it that, that organizations may be seeing that perhaps the way they were structured before may not be the structure as they go forward?
Yes, you definitely hear a lot of stories from executives about how, you know, the pandemic and responding to it had led to flattened hierarchies, you know, more democratized information, less micromanagement, you know, focusing more on outcomes over inputs. So, you know, there is definitely a promising sign, but it remains to be seen how much of this will last. Because, you know, in any crisis, Jane, power moves to the periphery. You know, a crisis pushes power out, and no hierarchical organization can handle the information processing demands and the decision-making requirements that a crisis presents. But, so that's the good news, right? But, you know, will the change last? And we've gone through other crises. In our book, we document how often people have declared that we're on a cusp of a new, you know, paradigm in organization. That, you know, we are now finally, we've reached the human era. But often, you know, bureaucracy reasserts itself rather quickly. You know, I mean, literally, if you go back to the 60s and the 70s and you hear what people were saying and the predictions people were making, that, you know, in 20 years from now, we'll be living in this, you know, in we'll be operating in organizations that, you know, resemble nothing like the organizations of the past. You know, it's just, you know, there these kinds of predictions where you know, very, very common. But if you look at the raw statistics around the number of layers people are under, the amount of time they spend, you know, dealing with, you know, process that isn't very value adding, the scope of autonomy that they have, the ability that they have to share in not only contribute their own ideas, but share in the fruits of their own innovations. Those are all fairly stagnant. And if anything, they've actually come down. So I think this presents an opportunity, you know, the crisis, people are getting woke, if you will. But, you know, if we don't take this concept of putting people at the center of organizations and flipping, you know, the paradigm, because in a typical bureaucracy, the human being is the instrument. They're the resources, not, you know, not for anything. They're, you know, human beings are called human resources. And we need to kind of flip it and say, no, you know, the human beings are the agents. They are, and the organization is the instrument. The organization is the vehicle by which, through which, you know, human beings can better their lives and the lives of those who they serve. And you know, that kind of shift in paradigm leads to a set of very different practices and different kinds of power relationships within a company. We can get into that, Jane. But unless we take that seriously and we really commit ourselves to changing the fundamental gears that operate organizations and this and the manager model, if you will, you know, then, you know, we won't have made much progress. And maybe the best that we are left with is being able to, you know, do meetings on Zoom in our pajamas.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh at that, but I think you make a very valid point, is that the crisis was addressed, and it's ironic because I've heard within the last week kind of two different very fuzzy logic statistics, one of which was only 40% will actually go back to the office, and the other was a large Wall Street bank now, you know, had 25% going back, now they have 50% going back. So there is a certain comfort, right, for some organizations in reverting back to what was familiar. Interestingly enough, Michaela, I find this particularly fascinating because in the tech space, we actually have almost two factions. So there is a faction of practices, of which DevOps is one of them, which really advocates for self-organizing, self-regulation systems. So teams get their work, they know what they have to do, they have they're empowered to make decisions. There's not a lot of layers they have to go through for approval, and they interact with each other. They optimize automation, and they are considered a stream of self-regulating teams. On the other hand, you have very traditional environments that are command and control, which means you can only go from step one to step two before an approval, and then there's a handoff, and then you've got to go, you know, right? And so it's really interesting that the shift to these self-organizing teams, for some organizations absolutely embrace it, and some organizations are scared by it. They're scared that if they're not micromanaging, if they don't know everything that everybody is doing other than Zoom meetings in pajamas, that somehow they've lost complete control and anarchy will ensue. How do they overcome that?
Yes. Well, first of all, probably by realizing that they have far less control than they believe they have. You know, making things simple for someone at the top to orchestrate work that is complex and interdependent means, in a way, losing a lot of the fidelity that you need to make sure that the right decisions are being made. So you might feel like you have enough control, but it's often an illusion. We have, a quote in the book from Jim Hagenam Schnabe, who at the time was, I think, the co-CEO or the chairman of SAP, who said that at some point he realized that SAP had 20,000 KPIs that were being tracked. And he said, you know, we basically put our brains on ice and we were running the organization by remote control. And, you know, it gave people comfort. We were measuring things, but were those the right things to be measuring? And, you know, was this really having an impact? So number one, you know, you probably don't have as much control as you think you do if you're micromanaging. Number two, you have to separate the what and the how. We control is very important, but micromanagement isn't the only way to achieve it. In fact, you know, there are a lot of companies in our book that have very few managers and very few top-down processes and very big staff functions that are able to, you know, have a level of efficiency and innovation that is industry leading. And the way they do that is by giving people not only the freedom to make decisions at, you know, the appropriate level, which is, you know, far down in the organization, but also the incentives, you know, they and the accountability. So they are the ones who bear the brunt, positive or negative, of decisions that they make. They give them the information so that they can make the appropriate decisions, right? And they give them the skills, the business skills or the functional skills, so that they know what's best, you know, for the customer and for the organization as a whole. And, you know, this, you know, there are examples from IT, but also from other industries where you might think that there's no reason to give people a lot of frontline autonomy, but we have a whole chapter on Nucor, the most innovative steel maker in the world. They have over 26,000 employees, $20 billion in revenue, and the whole company is managed in the self-organizing teams at the front line, who get paid for their own productivity, who have they know exactly who their customer is. They interact directly with the customer. These are frontline people. You know, they understand the economics of steel. They have the autonomy to, you know, buy equipment, to experiment with the equipment so they can make it even more productive. And, you know, they just, you know, and they do this. And as I said, they're the ones who bring the most innovative process improvements in the industry. They have no CTO. They have no, well, in fact, the CEO would say, tell you, it's not quite true. We don't have a CTO. We do, and it's 26,000 people strong, right? So it's, everybody is responsible for driving technological improvements, and so you basically, you know, there is a way to have, you know, in a way the cake and eat it too, right? To have the discipline and efficiency that comes with bureaucracy, with the innovation, the resilience that comes from what we call humanocracy, which is, you know, a different way of organizing and managing, people and processes.
And I'm sure there's some characteristics of the organizational culture that take time to groom, right? From everything you're describing, and I love that, right? Because what we're doing is we're challenging people to be their best, to succeed, right? To innovate, to work with each other without that kind of robotic, she says, with a little bit of a pun, with everything happening with robotics, those mm-hmm. human robots where I tell you what to do, when to do it, how to do it, and when to clock out, right? And so we train people that way, right? We train people not to make decisions. And I love what you're describing, because it is making the most of something that at least today only humans can do, which is really critical thinking. We will put in the link to the book, obviously, as we publish this podcast. But if I'm a leader in an organization, and so, you know, now I've read the book, I'm all excited about it. Step one, right? Because obviously there's baby steps. What would be a piece of advice that you would give a leader who's thinking, you know what, it's time for us to really embrace the strategies behind humanocracy?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question, Jay, because I think the stumbling block in previous efforts at busting bureaucracy has always been the migration. So how do I get from A to B? You know, we describe companies that some of them were born this way, other ones became post-bureaucratic through crisis and a transformational leader. But what if you're not, you know, your company is not going through an existential crisis? We're all obviously in crisis mode now, but maybe we're not teetering on the brink of oblivion, right? But we don't have the luxury of starting over. How do you change, right? It's not. And you mentioned earlier, maybe this is before we started recording, Jane, but companies willing, you know, and trying to copy the Spotify model, and yeah. That being all the rage with the squads and the tribes and so on. And, you know, it's interesting. I've heard people that are close to those kinds of examples coming away feeling a little, skeptical about how deeply those changes are actually being instantiated. I mean, because it's one thing to just copy the surface level practices and rebranding certain things in the company according to that terminology. It's quite another to change both mindsets and practices, right? So, you know, I don't think the solution is as simple as, you know, copy and paste and the promise that within 6 months you're just going to be able to move from, you know, one system or one model to the next. You know, organizations are very complex systems, and it's pretty unrealistic to assume that you can just pivot cleanly and quickly, right? So it is hard work, but we think that it's worth the effort given the payoff, both in terms of the human well-being as well as the productivity advantage that you get from ditching bureaucracy. So practically speaking, where do you begin? And so we have, you know, we lay out three different levels at which you should think about operating. One is individually, one is at the level of your work group, right? And one is at the level of the entire organization. And maybe, you know, the one we could start with is really around changing yourself, right? So just to change our organizations, we must, you know, first change ourselves, right? We must own our part in perpetuating kind of bureaucracy, especially if we are in a position where we have positional authority. And this means, you know, thinking about how, you know, bureaucracy maybe if you let me use this expression, makes assholes of us all, and then, you know, finding ways to, you know, reverse that, you know, and doing some soul repair, right? And think about, like, how has bureaucracy eaten away at our own humanity? So here's a simple exercise that our listeners can do. So reflect on your own actions across the last week or maybe the last month, and ask yourself these five questions. First, you know, did I subtly undermine a rival? In a bureaucracy, you know, power is zero sum. When a slot opens up, only one person gets promoted, right? It's a zero sum game, and it's a battle where you move ahead. And in that kind of a battle, it's tempting to discount the contributions of others or sow doubts about their integrity or their competence. So that's number one. Number two, did I fake enthusiasm for one of my boss's ideas? You know, in a bureaucracy, disagreeing with your boss can be not so great for your career. And individuals often swallow their reservations rather than risk being seen as disloyal. Third, you know, did I disregard the human cost of a decision? If our organization treats people as resources, as I mentioned earlier, we might be pushed to making decisions that sacrifice trust or, you know, the relational bonds between people for short-term business gains, right? So just checking on that and making sure that doesn't happen. And then the last two quickly, Jane, four, did I play it safe when I should have been bold? You know, bureaucracies tend to penalize screw-ups and more so than they penalize people sitting on their hands. And so it's often tempting to defend timidity as prudence when it's actually not. And then the last one is, you know, did I unfairly deflect blame or claim credit? In a bureaucracy, performance assessments are typically focused on individuals, not teams. And the goal is to be, you know, Teflon when the shit hits the fan and Velcro when awards are being handed out, right?
Yes.
And this behavior distorts reputations and it misallocates rewards. But it's kind of the only way to win an individualistic organization. So you know, these are five questions you can ask yourself and set aside some time and work through these questions. We actually have a longer list and some additional advice in the book on how to work through these. You know, grab a journal, do a spreadsheet, and just start to think about, when did I do this? What was the trigger? And how am I reduce my chances of being triggered? And make this a regular exercise and even ask your colleagues, you know, to help you keep yourself honest. So that's just one set of things you can do. And then, you know, start individually and then, you know, change will then propagate from there.
Well, and it's interesting, as you were asking the questions, I was self-reflecting myself. So very, very powerful questions, really. And I think my team's next book club, I know what the book is going to be, really fantastic. And I think very human for, you know, and accept the pun for what it's worth, because the humanity, you're right, the humanity of work is, I think, what's going to propel us forward if we get not only the right support, but also, and again, before we were recording, I said this, you know, there's some misbelief that culture is surgical, that we can remove the old culture, and it instill and we change human behavior, we change leader behavior, and then that we have the confidence and trust in ourselves and in the people that we work with, that if the answer is I have reservations or I don't want to deflect the blame, I want to accept the blame, then we should be comfortable doing that. So I wish we could talk forever, because I'm really thoroughly enjoying this. So thank you so much for sharing with us. We will put up the link to Amazon for our listeners to purchase the book. Really worthwhile. I said my team's getting a gift from me, so I'm very excited about that. Is there a website or other resources that you want to share?
Yeah, Jane, I think the best address is humanocracy.com, and there your listeners will be able to download the preface in chapter one and access a number of tools and videos from Gary and me. So that would be the place to go, humanocracy.com. And I will just make, Jane, we may be running out of time, but one special plea to your audience, because I think they're so well positioned to be catalysts for change in organizations, having, you know, working in IT. As I mentioned before, IT could be the enabler of fundamentally new and more progressive ways of organizing. It could go, frankly, the other way, right? IT could become the enabler of digital Taylorism, where everything is checked, you know, every keystroke is recorded, and you can tell whether people are working or not. And, you know, the algorithm could be an even worse boss than your supervisor. So there's a choice we can make here. And I think, you know, IT could help create, and it's actually not an accident that a lot of these organizations we detail in the book have incredibly robust information systems that allow the level of granularity around performance, that allow people to be connected with each other in communities that span silos, that are cross-cutting. And so, you know, without, you know, and also that enable change to happen at large scale in a distributed fashion. You know, the kinds of technologies that we have now that allow us to, you know, create a bit of a management revolution where not around 20 years ago. So it's much easier and much, we have better odds at not, you know, at succeeding where a lot of previous attempts at busted bureaucracy failed. And so I urge your listeners in IT to, you know, think of themselves as a little bit the enablers, the catalysts for this change, you know, working not only within IT, but across it, and liaising with our colleagues and asking them, what can we do to help you, you know, rethink, you know, processes such as strategy, budgeting, performance review, performance management, and so on. Because I think, you know, it's through the support of IT and these emerging technologies that we'll be able to make a difference.
And I think you're absolutely right. You know, one of the things that's become very clear over the last, say, 5 to 10 years is that every organization, regardless of what their vertical is a technology organization. So encouraging the technology stack, the IT organization, to be the agents of change is very timely, because I think that we as an industry can show that the breaking down of bureaucracy actually results in increased revenue, better competitive advantage, and the ability to transform. That word is really overused, but the ability to transform to the requirements of the new decade. Thank you so much. I so appreciate your time. Very, very excited about where this goes. We'll add the book, of course, to our book corner. And I'm really looking to see how this can really help shape or reshape, you know, the landscape of today's enterprise, particularly those that are afraid that they're going to fall behind. I also have a plea to our audience. DevOps Institute opened the Upskilling Enterprise DevOps Skills Survey a couple of weeks ago. Some of you know this is our third year. We look for thousands of responses around the world to help us understand what is the state of the human in the equation known as DevOps. And Michaela, one of the things that's been proven the last few years is that human skills are considered equally essential by the respondents to this pretty deep survey as their automation and their process skills. So this year in particular, it's been such a strange year. I'm sure everybody knows that. Please take a few minutes. It takes you about 20 minutes to fill out the survey. So if you're listening, please go up to our website, give us your input, regardless of what region you are. We collect a lot of global data, and the report will publish early next year. Caleb, thank you so much. Again, such valuable information. I'm hoping that we could get back together and do another podcast in a few months and see the impact of this new, I wouldn't even say operating model, I would say new way of thinking as much as new way of operating, and the impact that you and the insight in the book have done. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
So again, if you're listening, this is the Humans of DevOps podcast. I'm very delighted to have been joined by Michaela Zannini, one of the co-authors of Humanocracy. We'll put in the link to get the book, and we'll also put in the link to humanocracy.com. So again, if you're listening, please stay safe, please stay well, please stay connected.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. Don't forget to join our global community to get access to even more great resources like this. Until next time, remember, you are part of something bigger than yourself. You belong.